history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some stories to tell, if only you take the time to listen. Each week on this program, we visit with members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We hear new stories each week. We're educated, we're entertained, and many times inspired. And I think we're going to check some of those boxes today with a 90-year-old Navy veteran who still fits into his Navy uniform. Maybe the hat doesn't fit quite right for Russ Jenkins, 90 years old, of Hollister, California, but originally from Okemah, Oklahoma. You got a little Cherokee blood in you. What was it like growing up as a kid out in Oklahoma?
Well, I'll tell you, I picked a lot of cotton there, ate a lot of watermelon. When I went to school there, they had actually had a game called Kick the Can. Believe you me, I got my shins kicked many a time roughing it out with that. We lived, the school was right in the middle of an Indian reservation. I got a school picture that it's all Indians, you know. I used to have to walk to school and walk through where some of them were living, and they used to scare the heck out of my cousin and I because they act like they were going to scalp us, you know. And it was really fun, you know, living there. And my teacher must have thought that I was a pretty bright kid because she took me to Okemah one time to have me tested to see how smart I was. And that was very, very seldom. We lived out in the country. I very seldom ever got to go into town. And the only time my dad went into town was to get supplies or take a load of cotton in or something like that.
And Okemah, one of its claims to fame is a guy who did something like you did. You're 90 years old. You still play the mouth harp, the harmonica, and you play your guitar a little bit. Somebody else did those things in Okemah. Who was that?
Yeah, that was Woody Guthrie. And old Woody used to stand around on the corner there in Okemah and play his guitar. And he had a holder that fit around his neck for his harmonica, and he'd play the harmonica. I never knew him at that time, but my uncles, my dad's brothers, all knew him, and they thought he was pretty kooky. But he ended up writing this song, "This Land Is My Land, This Land Is Your Land, From California to the New York Islands."
I bet you've played that on your guitar a couple times.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But you didn't stay in Oklahoma. I've interviewed a lot of folks, and I ask them all about the Great Depression and living through it. And when folks I'm talking to were in Oklahoma, there was something that caused a lot of them to move west. What do you remember about all that?
We left when I was about 9 or 10 years old. And we went to, from there to Peoria, Arizona. I had a grandfather by the name of William Mills, and he was a gambler. And he occasionally would gamble everything away on their farm, and he'd leave home for 2 or 3 years at a time. Because he had a couple of good-sized sons that didn't care much for him when he did that. Anyway, our trip to Arizona was to try to get Grandpa Mills to go back home. And we were there about 5 months, and it was getting into wintertime, and my dad decided that he wanted to go to Grand Junction, Colorado, to visit his sister, who lived there right on the Colorado River. And so we went there. We had a 1928 Model A Ford four-door, pulling a four-wheel wagon that was loaded down with all their household effects. I can't imagine to this day how that Ford made it all that long trip. When we got to Colorado, Colorado River was froze over solid, which never happened all that often, and you could ice skate on it. I tried to learn how to ice skate, but my cousins, they had the kind of ice skates that you clamped onto the sole of your shoes. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, I almost broke both ankles trying to learn how to ice skate. But anyway, we left there and went to California along when springtime came. I had never ridden a bicycle when we were there in Colorado. And my cousin let me use his bicycle. I was going down the sidewalk, which weren't supposed to be riding on, of course. And I ran into this guy and knocked him off the sidewalk, and I almost got in trouble over that. But anyway, we did. We took off for California and went over the Rockies there. Boy, I remember going uphill with that four-wheel trailer loaded and this Model A four-cylinder Model A Ford pulling it. My mom and I had to get behind the trailer and push, and it's a wonder that thing didn't back over us, and you know, but we made it over the hill and into Salida, California. We slid into Salida. Mm-hmm. And and we stayed there through the spring, and then we went to Chowchilla, stayed there for, I guess we were there all together about 4 or 5 years. It seemed like a lifetime to me at the time, but then we ended up moving to Fresno, which was a very good thing for me because my folks joined a really nice church there, and I got to meet some real neat kids that were musicians. I played guitar and harmonica, and the preacher had a 30-minute program on radio, and he had us young musicians play for him when his opening ceremony was open up them golden gates. I would cut loose with my harmonica and rest of them with their guitars and what have you.
Do you remember the name of that church or that radio station?
I really don't. It's been so doggone long.
The radio station might be one of the radio stations this program is on all these years later. Who knows?
The closing song, you know, Open Up Them Golden Gates was the opening song for his sermon. And the closing song was When the Saints Go Marching In. Mm-hmm. So I was really cutting loose on When the Saints Go Marching In on my harmonica. And then the guy that had the controls in the control room gave a cut, and I didn't see it. And I did a shave and a haircut, 6 bits at the end of the When the Saints Go Marching In. And I really got ribbed about that for a long time.
I bet you did. And you ended up going to high school there, Roosevelt High School, which is still there in Fresno. And that's where you were, in Fresno, on December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about how you found out?
I was in a shop class. And somebody came running in and said, the Japanese has bombed Pearl Harbor. Everybody ran to where a radio was and listened in. And it was a really, really sad, exciting time. So not too long after that, in January, I dropped out of school. I was just starting 11th grade. I dropped out of school and went up to Oakland to stay with my aunt and uncle. Next day after I got there, I went and found out where the hiring hall was for the shipyards. I went there and I got in line to see about a job. And I walks up to the window and the lady says, identification? I says, I don't have any. She says, you mean you don't have a driver's license? I said, I don't drive, which was a big fat lie because I drove Caterpillar tractors and everything. And she says, well, how about a draft card? I said, you know, I just turned 18 and I haven't went down and signed up yet, but I plan on doing that in the next day or so. So she calls this other woman over and she says, does he look like he's 18? And she looks at me and winked at me. Because I was 6 foot tall at the time. Since then, I've shrunk 2 inches at 90. So she said, sure, yeah, he looks like he's 18. They hired me, and I went over to the number 3 Kaiser Shipyard in Richmond and started work over there, and ended up going to this little school they had to teach people how to weld and use a acetylene cutting torch and that sort of thing. So I ended up being a acetylene torch metal cutter there for a year before I went in the Navy.
Well, and you told her you were 18, but in reality you were 16, so you were telling a pretty big fib there. What made you want to drop out of school and go up there to the shipyards?
Well, I had a good buddy that had done that a couple of weeks before I did.
And was his decision in response to Pearl Harbor?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And that's what I want to get at, because, you know, most of us listening were not alive when this happened. And we've lived through 9/11 and maybe some other, you know, traumatic days in American history. But I don't know if we really understand the sentiment that that produced and what it sparked in you. Can you describe for us what that made you feel and why it was so important for you to do something about it?
I just felt like it was a thing to do, since I couldn't join the service at that time, although a lot of kids lied about their age. And
so did you, just not to the Navy.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. But that shipyard, at number 3 Kaiser Shipyard, they built ships in a basin, and then it was right by the edge of the water. When they got them finished, they just opened the big old doors they had and floated the ship right out into the ocean. It was absolutely amazing.
Are those the Liberty ships, like the one they still have, the Jeremiah O'Brien in San Francisco?
Yeah, they were Liberty ships, that's for sure.
And you guys pumped them out of there pretty fast, from what I understand.
Yeah.
How did your parents feel about all this, about you dropping out of school, leaving home, and going to weld ships together?
My mom had about a 7th grade education. My dad had about a 5th. I don't think that they put that much thought into me being educated, unfortunately.
So you're at the shipyards for about a year, and then at age 17, you join the Navy. What, because you're already doing something for the war effort. I mean, producing these ships is a big deal. What made you decide that you needed to get into the Navy?
Well, I just felt like it was a thing to do. I had a couple of buddies that had already gone in. So I signed up over in Oakland and took my physical there. Then they sent me over to the federal building in San Francisco to swear in. And from there, we went by train to Farragut, Idaho, in the middle of winter. And I had on real light clothing and stepped off the train up there in the foot of snow in February, and about froze my fanny off before I got my Navy blues and my Navy uniforms that I could wear.
And that's one thing for a kid, you know, who's coming from somewhere in the middle of the country, but here you've been right in the Bay Area watching all these Navy ships go by every day, and you want to get into a part of that, and they send you to the snow. You must have been saying, what's the deal here? I got hoodwinked.
Yeah, well, you know, Farragut, Idaho is right up by Coeur d'Alene.
It's almost to Canada.
Yeah, it was right smack dab in the middle of a forest. And in 9 months, they cleared enough of those big trees, pine trees, I guess they were, off to make 5 or 6, I think it was 6 different boot camp places there, and a big hospital, and a big drill hall, and all that. It used to take 3 months, but they put us through in 2 months. So we left there. I was assigned to Acorn outfit in Port Hueneme, California. We went through commando training in Port Hueneme with live ammunition crawling under wires on our bellies. And believe you me, we kept our heads down. I had my chin dragging in the dirt.
I want to make sure everybody heard that. You said live ammunition. In other words, if you stick your head up, your head's gone.
You got creased. Yeah, right. We had commando training there for 6 weeks. And then we joined up with this 77th CB Battalion. They came from back east, Virginia or someplace, where they did their initial training. And then they ended up in Port Hueneme to be shipped out of there over into the South Pacific. And we left out of Port Hueneme. We loaded those 2 ships up, one with all of our crew. There was about 500 guys in the 77th CB Battalion, and there was 48 of us Acorn 11 crew, which was a aviation unit that was attached to the CB Battalion, because when they took an island over, they only took islands that had fighter strips on them. We would go in, and of course we'd already bombed the heck out of that fighter strip, and they'd have to go in and fill all the bomb holes and the runways and what have you. And then they would erect tents and then from there they'd do Quonset huts, and then we'd get that all set up and turn it over to another outfit, and we'd go and do the same thing on another island.
So your job basically was to get these captured airstrips in good enough shape for American forces to actually operate them.
That's right, yeah.
So what specifically did you do?
I worked on aircraft engines. I was an aviation mechanic.
So in 2015, if people hear ACORN, they're either thinking about an oak tree or there was some news with President Obama and community organizing or something. But you're talking about an ACORN unit attached to a construction battalion. So the Navy Seabees were all over the Pacific getting these facilities going. But so you're actually working directly with aircraft, though. What kinds of Navy planes did you work on?
Oh, I worked on all the fighters. Started off with the F-4Fs and then the FMs. From there, we had the F-4Us, the Corsair. Then we had the F-6Fs later on.
And I know you worked with dive bombers and torpedo bombers, too. And you weren't getting shot at every day, but you did get a taste of that. And you experienced some very emotional moments in your Navy career. We're going to touch on some of those when we come back with 90-year-old Russ Jenkins of Hollister, California. Hop on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and videos of Russ, including him playing the harmonica, which you're hearing a little bit of right now as we head to break. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today still fits into his Navy uniform at age 90, and you'll find photographic evidence of that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Russ Jenkins told us about his childhood in Okemah, Oklahoma, how he moved west, lied about his age, and went to work in the Kaiser shipyards at 16, joined the Navy at 17, and stayed in for 20 years. He worked on Navy aircraft in the Pacific Theater, and his first stop was Guadalcanal, where earlier that year the Allies had finally prevailed in a 6-month battle that cost more than 7,000 Americans their lives and saw nearly 8,000 more wounded. And here you are, a teenager, not even 18 yet, and you get to Guadalcanal, and this is 1943. The battle wasn't too long ago.
Japanese planes came over to bomb us. They called them Washing Machine Charlies, and they were flying up just as high as they could be, dropping bombs from up there. Right, yeah.
This is your first taste of the war, really. Is that Guadalcanal?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, when we first got there with the Seabees, we were just setting up camp and everything when a Japanese plane came right down the coast and hit us with personnel bombs and machine guns, made 2 passes at us. Fortunately, there wasn't anybody killed, and there was just guys all bruised up and everything from diving into foxholes. That was the first time we were in the actual battle with the Japanese.
Well, and I imagine that would get your attention. Like I just said, you weren't even 18 years old yet. Did that scare you a little bit?
We landed on Guadalcanal the 2nd of September, 1943, and I turned 18 on the 21st of September. And I knew how to drive a Caterpillar because I'd done it a lot on farm. down in Fresno when we were down there. They let me drive this cat. It had a blade on it, and I was digging up the sides of the beach there and ran into a spot where a whole bunch of Japanese bodies had been buried, and it was the stinkingest awful mess there ever was. And I got out of there, and I covered that up in a hurry. But that's why they call that beach, Cocombona Beach, Maggot Beach, was because of that situation there where they had so many bodies buried.
That's just the way it was. That's the harsh reality of war. But what did that do to you as a teenager to have to experience that and witness it and try to process it?
I just tried to wipe it off of my mind, you know. Had anti-aircraft guns set up at Tulagi, which was an island just off of Guadalcanal. And they used to shoot at the washing machine Charlies when they were up there. And every once in a while, they would hit one and bring it down. Then we had a Marine fighter pilot that when they got radar, first time they had it, it was very crude, I think. But they were able to zero in on those bombers. And he shot down three of them in one night. That was always pretty exciting when anti-aircraft guns would open up over there on Tulagi, and they had tracers, and they were just zigzagging all over the place, you know.
So this is at nighttime, so those tracers are lighting up the sky. It's quite the fireworks show for you.
Yes, they were, because they had about a dozen anti-aircraft guns over there, and boy, let me tell you. But those Japanese bombers, they tried to get as high as they could and stay away from those anti-aircraft guns, you know.
They learned their lesson. I've got to ask you about yourself. And I know you weren't there, you know, while the island was being taken, which was a bloody, bloody battle. It would cost a lot of Marines their life. You got there right after. But the first day you're there, a Japanese bomber comes over, is dropping anti-personnel bombs and strafing you guys. That would get my attention. Were you afraid? Were you scared? Were you thinking, I don't know if I'm going to see my 18th birthday?
Yeah, I sure was. It rained practically all the time in out there in the South Pacific. In fact, one island that we were on was called Ondanga, and this was after I was with the Seabees for quite a while. This island was just big enough for an airstrip. It was probably no more than a mile wide and about 3 miles long. The Seabees had what they call Morrison matting, and it was steel strips that interlocked, and they could lay them down on the runway and make a solid runway so that planes could land without bogging down when they got on the runway. This particular place, Ondanga, was way up towards the front where the fighting was going on. This guy, Major Boyington, they were flying Corsairs, F4U, and he came in and landed, and one of his guys was circling to land, and all of a sudden he peeled off and dove into the ocean right there. And when Boyington was climbing down out of his cockpit, he had tears running down his face. I'll never forget that. It was so sad.
Well, and of course, people know that name, Greg Pappy Boyington, one of the legendary aces of World War II and the head of the Black Sheep Squadron, made famous by the television series. But you saw, you know, he's known for bravado and fearlessness and courage, and you saw a softer side in that moment.
Yeah, that's right. And later on, after he had about, I think he had about 25 kills or so, his plane got shot down, and he ended up in a Japanese prison camp over in Japan. They were very cruel to all of the American prisoners. The Japanese were absolutely terrible when it came to how they treated the prisoners. In the first place, they practically starved them to death. They were allotted food by the Japanese government, but then the people that ran the prison camps would take the food and sell most of it back to the civilians. That's why the American prisoners were starving to death over there. We've seen pictures of some of them. They were absolutely nothing but skin and bones.
I've talked to some of them on this show. Incredible stories that they have. As for you, so you're witnessing things like this. I'm sure you're sensing different things that pose a threat to you and your chances of getting back to the States, of having a family someday, and having the life that you look back on now at age 90. When you think back, are there some moments or situations that you would regard as the closest calls you endured?
Actually, other than that initial engagement that we had there right after we landed on Guadalcanal with the CB, 77 CB Battalion, later on I got transferred into an aviation repair unit, and I was in that for a year before I came back to States. And that was where I really got checked out on working on airplanes and all different kinds. We even had a couple of planes from cruisers. One was called the Duck and the other one was called the Goose. And they had inertia starters on them.
And people don't understand how primitive some of our technology was at this time. And I think I just heard you say you're out there playing Duck, Duck, Goose in the Pacific. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Those cruiser planes, they had, like I said, inertia starters. You had to wind them up. It was like winding up
a Model T Ford?
Yeah, right. Then you'd get to going real good, and you had a crank that you stuck into the side of the engine, and you wound it, and you got it going at a pretty good rate. Then the guy in the cockpit, you'd say contact, and he would hit the switch, and then that would kick the engine over and it would usually start, you hoped. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to do that anymore.
Well, one of the things I love about doing this show is you meet so many different people who had so many different jobs during World War II. 16 million people in the military, and there's a lot of different roles they played. And we hear so much and we think so much about the Pappy Boyingtons and the other guys flying these planes, or even the gunners on these planes, and we think those are the guys who are right out there risking their lives. But you had a pretty big responsibility, it seems to me. If you have to repair these aircraft and make sure they're flight-worthy, you're really holding some lives in your hands, aren't you?
Yes, that's true. Fortunately for me, I worked in engine build-up first when I was in this aviation repair unit. We took the new engines out of a can, they call it, a big round can. We'd put them on a stand, and then we'd put all of the accessories and the wiring and all that on them, and then we'd take them out to the line where the fighter planes were, and they had already pulled the old engine out of those planes, and then we would put the new engine in, get it all wired up and tuned up and everything. Then you'd have to get in them and run them for so many hours before they started flying them. And then we would tune them up in between, set the carburetors and set the distributors and magnetos. That was really big stuff for a young kid that was only 18 at the time to get in those planes and run them up like you were the pilot. But, you know, they would have those things. I don't know how they kept them from taking off. It'd have a big metal shaft driven into the ground. They must have had it driven in 6 feet. Those F4Us, those big engines, 2,800 engines, 18-cylinder, they would really put out the air, the four-bladed prop. I often wondered what would happen if they pulled that stake out of the ground. I'd still be flying around up there someplace, probably.
Well, that begs the question, though, and I'm sure everybody listening is saying, wow, if I was 18 years old and that was my job and I'm around these planes all day long, every day, I'm begging for a chance to get up in the air in one of these birds. Did you ever get to get airborne in some of those planes you worked on?
No, I never did. They were mostly all single cockpit planes, you know, except for the SBDs. You know, we also had the TBFs and TBMs. We worked on those too. And that plane, the TBF, was the one that President Bush, he was shot down over the Pacific. His radioman and gunner both didn't make it, but he did. And amazingly enough, a submarine was patrolling that area, and they picked up on him getting shot down and came in and rescued him. To this day, I still am in wonder of that happening. And then he goes on to become president of the United States. That was really something.
Let's get the rest of your story. What are some of the things that, when you look back on your time in World War II specifically, I know you're in the Navy for 20 years, but specifically with World War II, the things that you remember that stick out in your mind or that you're proud of?
Well, when I was on the Antietam, right after I got aboard, a friend of mine was the same rate as me. They called us aviation machinist mates, and that rating name came from World War One, when mechanics used to have to machine some of their own parts, and that just stayed with that rate right up to World War Two. But anyway, this friend of mine, he was on the SB-2C, which was the airplane that was that I flew on in my squadron. He had either an engine failure, which they think it was, rather than a cat shot. They used hydraulic, they call them cats, catapults, to fly the planes off of the aircraft carrier and get them airborne. Anyway, they had a engine failure on takeoff, and they ended up right in the path of the aircraft carrier, and they have a bow lookout, but he gave the bridge the wrong information. The ship cut right through where the SB-2C was, and the pilot went down one side, and he was okay one side of the ship, and this friend of mine went down the other, and he got sucked into the prop. And it just cut him in two. And there was a destroyer pulled alongside to pull him out, and he was still alive. And he said, "I'm gone. Don't pull me out." But they did anyway. But he was practically cut in two. But anyway, foolish me, I decided to start taking the rides in the SB-2Cs because I was checked out rear gunner. We had twin 50. Machine guns. We had a real old type radar. It had a little disc and a little dot would show on the disc. But anyway, I flew off of the ship I don't know how many times, probably a couple hundred. On coming in for a landing, you had we had a tail hook, and we'd drop the tail hook down, and pilot would maneuver in and try to catch the wire, they called it. And there was three wires that if you missed the first one, hopefully you're going to catch a second or third one. But if you didn't, well, you had to take off. Sometimes they didn't take off soon enough. And in those days, they didn't have the canted deck, they call it, which veered off to the side of the ship. They just had a barrier up front that was made out of this webbing. The plane would just plow into that, and mostly it would tear it all out and then run in and knock out about two or three of our planes. Those were exciting times, let me tell you.
Well, and when you talk about going up in the air 200 times in those SB-2Cs, maybe some people are listening and saying, wait a second, the war's over. What are they doing flying these planes all over the place?
They're training flights, just for training purposes. We would go out and fly around, and then we would act like we were going to come in and bomb a ship. You know, it was really exciting times for somebody like me, you know. Since I wasn't a pilot, I was next best thing to it, you know.
So that was on the aircraft carrier USS Antietam in the Pacific while the Chinese Civil War was going on. But we have more to discuss about World War II and also Mr. Jenkins' haunting connection to a tragic day in Navy history. As we head to another break, the guitar plucking you hear comes courtesy of his 90-year-old fingers. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Continuing our conversation with 90-year-old Navy veteran Russ Jenkins of Hollister, California. Anyone who was in the Pacific for as long as you were during World War II, Russ, seems to have some kind of memory of Tokyo Rose, the infamous Japanese radio propaganda artist who was voiced at different times by different women, but most famously by a Southern California native named Eva Toguri, who was convicted of treason after the war and spent a decade in prison. You remember here in Tokyo Rose?
Oh, yeah, we got her all the time. When I was in the Aviation Repair Unit, it was Aviation Repair Unit Navy 145 was the name of it, and she used to tune in and, you know, say, "This is a sailor's best friend, Tokyo Rose, bringing you the latest from the war news." She would talk about how the Japanese Navy and Air Force, they were all whipping the heck out of the Americans, you know. And, of course, it was all a big fat lie. And but she played some really good music, you know. She would give us some Frank Sinatra and some all the other, the big bands, you know, and that kind of stuff. I don't know where she got all that music. Maybe she took it over with her. You know, she got pardoned. She came back to the United States after, and she finally got pardoned.
What about VJ Day, victory over Japan? Where were you? How'd you find out?
I came back from the South Pacific February or March 1945. And I was assigned to overhaul and repair outfit at Alameda. And then I heard about this deal where you could get subsistence and quarters pay on shore patrol in Oakland. So I put in for it and I got it. A couple months later, I took the test for first class petty officer, and I passed that with flying colors with all the experience that I had in that aviation repair unit and elsewhere. So I was on shore patrol for a year. Well, it was all on Broadway, from 7th and Broadway to 22nd and Broadway. It was a bowling alley down at on 22nd and Broadway. And then there was a dance hall called the Uptown Ballroom on the left side of Broadway going down towards 22nd. It seemed like it was about a 3 stories up because they didn't have an elevator and the stairway just seemed to go straight up. So we would go up there and check that out. I'd been up there a couple times. They had a nice little restaurant there. They had a 12-piece orchestra. And I mean, they were really good. And they had one of those lights that went around. Everything was real sort of dark in the ballroom, and the light went around and it had these little arrows of light that went out and hit people, you know, and whatever. And I got to looking in there and I said, all these women are in there dancing together, nothing but women. And I thought, now wait a minute, that don't seem right. So guess where I spent quite a bit of my liberty from then on?
On the dance floor.
Yeah, taking those women, tapping them on the shoulder and cutting in on the two of them dancing together. Of course, they were tickled to death to have us men people coming in and joining them, you know.
Well, and if my timeline's right, you would have been on shore patrol in Oakland for both VE Day and VJ Day. I imagine you saw some things.
The first one was VE Day, of course. They signed gosh, it must have been 100 extra shore patrol guys, just temporary duty, temporary shore patrol. They give them an armband and a baton. So they are all supposed to go out and keep people from getting in trouble. But the next day, we found armbands and batons all over the city. As I said, guys actually deserted their posts.
Swept up in the celebration, huh?
Yes, they did, yeah.
Can you describe that for us, what it looked like, what it sounded like, those celebrations?
It was absolutely fantastic. There was so much joy, you know, from the end of the war over in Europe. You know, I didn't mention, but my uncle, Thurman Jenkins, they call him Red because he was a redhead, he got captured during the Battle of the Bulge, and he was prisoner of war over there, and he had a lot of stories to tell.
Well, that made VE Day significant for your family, huh? And he was probably liberated right before that.
Yes, he was, yeah. So that was a joyous time for his wife and family, you know, and all the rest of us, too.
And what about VJ Day? Was it any crazier in the Bay Area then?
It was even crazier than VE Day was, yeah. It was just the same thing all over again, you know, with the missing armbands and batons.
Did that mean something to you personally? Because here, you got involved in this, even in the shipyards before the Navy, pretty close to the beginning of the war, and now it's finally over. What did that mean to you?
Oh, that was a very joyous occasion, you know. It was hard to explain, you know, how great it was. I'll never forget it. You know, it was such a great day.
You know, you told us a story about Pappy Boyington and seeing the emotion he dealt with after the loss of one of his buddies. There's another famous name that you interacted with in your Navy career, and that was during your shore patrol days, I think, right? Did you have any idea you were working with a future astronaut?
Yeah, this was on my second hitch after I was assigned to duty in Corpus Christi, Texas, after leaving the Antietam, the aircraft carrier Antietam. I was assigned to shore patrol duty for a three-month period there in Corpus Christi, and my shore patrol officer was Captain John Glenn, the astronaut. I used to play AC-Deucy with him quite a bit. He was a great guy. I really liked him.
Well, I know we're about out of time, but 20 years in the Navy, you've told us a few of the things you did. Later on, you were flying admirals around as a flight engineer on a big R-6D. But 20 years in the Navy, what are you most proud of?
Well, yeah, I was proud of all of it, of course, but when I was stationed in Japan, I was able to bring my family over there. Place called Seijo Machi. It's where they had these movie studios where they made the Seventh Samurai movie. We shared a house with this Takahashi family, and they were really, really good to us. And when I first got my family over there, they had a coal strike on, and they manufactured their gas. In the evening, we'd have a little flame about an inch high on a stove burner, and the same way in the morning, just enough to fry an egg and what have you. And we almost froze to death. And and so we finally got a diesel heater. Everybody in Japan and also in Philippines, I was stationed in the Philippines for 2 years. The women all had maids. Our maid's name was Shima. The kids all called her Mrs. Shima, and of course we started calling her Mrs. Shima too, even though she was a maid, you know. But I'd came home from work at Atsugi Air Base, and I was taking Mrs. Shima to her home after her shift working with us. She had the that oil heater, which had a 5 gallon capacity, had ran out of diesel fuel, and she had gone out to the 55 gallon drum that we had out in the garage there and filled the 5 gallon tank up and brought it back and installed it on the stove and lit it. And in the meantime, she hadn't turned the valve off, which let the diesel fuel into the basket in the stove, and it was full of diesel fuel, and it had taken off. And when I got home, the flames were shooting about 50 feet out of the chimney of the house.
Oh my
and my wife and two kids were running in and out of the house. They would look up at the see the flames, and then they'd run back. So I realized right away what probably happened. I ran in and turned it off, and it was white hot. The heater was just sitting there jumping up and down and rumbling. So I turned it off, and then it finally cooled down.
I do really want to know, and I'm sure our listeners want to know, what you're most proud of when it comes to your service, and why you think it's important for us to remember these times in our history and what happened.
One of the things that I'm most proud of is when I was stationed in Patuxent River, Maryland on my last hitch, and I was flying the Chief of Naval Operations and a bunch of other admirals around. Like, I had Admiral Anderson and Admiral Ollie Burke. 30-knot Burke, they called him. Those were really exciting times. They had to go into all these terrible places like Paris and Athens, Greece, and Barcelona, Spain, and often wondered why they had so much business in these places. But then we used to fly down to Lima, Peru quite a bit. One thing I didn't mention that I'd like to mention if I have time. In 1960, I was plane captain on this plane that was flying the Navy band around for President Eisenhower when the North American Alliance thing was going on down in South America. We had dropped the band off in Buenos Aires and went back by Patuxent River, Maryland Naval Air Station to do a major maintenance check on the airplane. And this buddy of mine, Jim Cordell, who was shop chief and a good friend of mine, begged me to let him take the rest of the flight. So he was a flight engineer also. And so I let him take it, and he took the plane back to Buenos Aires, picked up the Navy band. We had they were APs, they called them. They were ex-enlisted pilots, but they had both been commissioned, and they were Lieutenant J.G.'s, and they were flying the airplane. They, like I said, picked the Navy band up in Buenos Aires, and they were going into Rio de Janeiro to drop it off for another engagement there that Eisenhower had. And they were holing at 5,000 feet over the inner harbor there, Sugarloaf Mountain. And Brazilian R-4D, old Goonie Bird, cut right in front of them. Instead of diving or pulling up, it swerved and it cut our plane right in two. Cut the tail of the plane off right in front of the tail. And there was two guys that were in that section that were still strapped in. And that plane from 5,000 feet, that tail section had enough aerodynamic stability to float down and plop in the water, and neither one of those guys had a scratch on them, but it killed everybody else. There was 18, it wasn't the full Navy band, of course, it's just a portion of it, 18 top-notch Navy band members that were killed, and crew, you know, and everybody on the plane except those two fellas.
So the guy that talked you out of being on that plane and said, I want your spot, and flew in what would have been your place, he died.
Yeah, and the two pilots, one of them's name was Hartshorn. He was from Wyoming, and his folks owned a big ranch up there, and they called him Doggy Hartshorn. And the other guy was a guy by the name of Jackson. But I, ever since then, I've had what they call survivor's guilt. And I wake up at night sometime kicking Arlene, trying to get out of that plane, you know. It's really the one thing that has really affected me deeply.
I could see that, and I'm just, no one can understand that unless they've lived through it. But and I know I've got to wrap up here, but I want to thank you for serving our country, first of all. 20 years in the Navy, and that story is sobering in its own right. Every veteran that I have on this show, almost all of them, somebody says, you need to go talk to so-and-so. And it was a lady named Linda from here in Hollister that said, you need to talk to Mr. Jenkins, because she met you at the hospital when you were volunteering there. Things like that, where you're giving back, is part of the thinking behind that, because you realize your life could have ended 55 years ago?
Absolutely. They buried the two pilots and quite a few of the Navy band members at Arlington National Cemetery up in Washington. We had to go, we didn't have to, but we went up and attended those funerals, and that was so sad. Yeah, so That was something that has really affected me.
And it sounds like as much as it weighs on you, it's also spurred you to make a difference in a lot of other people's lives.
I try to.
Well, don't stop.
Okay.
Russ Jenkins, 90 years old. I'm so thankful we got to hear that last story, and I think we really heard his heart. It's always a privilege to meet these humble heroes from our greatest generation and share their stories with you. We're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.